greater connectivity benefits the greater good. And Qualcomm invented 5G breakthroughs that make it possible. See us where 5G is taking on some of the world's biggest challenges. Join us in making the world more connected with 5G.
This is your tech news briefing for Tuesday, March 8th. I'm Zoe Thomas for the Wall Street Journal. For parents and lawmakers, keeping kids safe online is a top priority. For social media companies trying to attract young users, it's something they can't ignore. So, how do you build a platform that kids actually want to be on while ensuring they aren't exposed to mature or potentially harmful content? On today's show, our reporter Yori Ko, who covers kids in tech for the Wall Street Journal, joins us to discuss how YouTube took on this challenge with its YouTube Kids app, and what other social media companies can learn from its struggles. That's after these headlines. Ukraine's internet is experiencing disruptions, likely as a result of Russian strikes on the country's infrastructure. That's according to the UK government. Outages have been reported in the capital Kyiv and other cities since the fighting began. Internet access in Ukraine has gotten a boost from SpaceX, which made its satellite internet system Starlink available there last week. CEO Elon Musk said the company would take extra steps to make Starlink more resilient against cyber attacks and efforts to jam its signal. More companies are pulling out of Russia. Netflix said it halted service in the country. A person familiar with the matter said growing sanctions and payment challenges made operating there too difficult. The streaming giant launched in Russia less than a year ago and has fewer than a million subscribers there. Meanwhile, over the weekend, TikTok suspended new video uploads and live streaming in Russia. The move came after Moscow put in place a law threatening up to 15 years in prison for anyone publishing what authorities consider to be false information about the invasion. TikTok's move is notable in part because it's owned by Chinese company ByteDance. China's had close ties with Moscow and hasn't embraced the Western-led sanctions of Russia in the wake of the invasion. In other tech news, at a virtual event this afternoon, Apple is expected to reveal the model of its first low-priced iPhone SE with 5G capabilities. It's also expected to show off an updated iPad Air with faster processor and 5G. Joining us to discuss what these new devices could mean for the tech giant is our reporter Tim Higgins, who covers Apple for us. Hi, Tim. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
The iPhone SE is Apple's smaller, cheaper phone. How popular have past versions of it been?
Well, it's not as sexy as the flagship phones that we see revealed in the fall. The SE does small business for Apple traditionally. It really had a breakout year in 2020 during the pandemic when it did pretty good sales. But it's not the huge moneymaker like the iPhone 13 is.
So how much do analysts expect the addition of 5G to help propel sales of the SE? And then, I guess, propel Apple, which already had a record year in sales last year.
Yeah, so the iPhone SE is the little phone, but this year it might play an outsized role. At least that's what some investors are betting. They think that the addition of 5G connectivity to the phone could help it be appealing to budget-conscious buyers in the U.S. who want to make the upgrade into 5G, but also make it more appealing in foreign markets such as China, where 5G is very important.
Let's talk about those international markets for a bit, because when the SE was launched, it was seen as a way to help grow in markets outside of the U.S. and Western Europe. Has it lived up to that? And is just adding on 5G capabilities really going to help it propel any further?
That's the question. And so the surprising thing, I think, among some analysts and some observers is that the SE did so well in the U.S. It really became kind of the entry into the Apple ecosystem from Android because of the price point. And overseas, in places like China, it didn't see the same kind of success, in part because there's much more competition from Android in the China market, but also in that market, there's a desire for a bigger screen. Plus, the phone didn't have 5G. So, you know, there's some question about what it's going to do in China. There's some belief that adding 5G will help it there. It also arrives at a time when Apple is seeing a greater success in China because of the market dynamics there, with some of its competitors being hurt. So there's this hope among some that this could really be the year for the SE in China.
All right, that was our reporter, Tim Higgins. Thanks for speaking with us, Tim.
Thank you.
And we report exclusively that gig companies, including Uber, Lyft, and DoorDash, are launching a campaign to head off efforts to classify their workers as employees. Democratic lawmakers, including President Biden, support measures to reclassify part-time independent contractors as employees, which would allow them to form unions. Labor unions have argued that gig economy companies exploit workers by not giving them enough hours on the job to qualify for health care and other benefits. In response, a new advocacy group formed by the app makers called Flex plans to run TV and internet ads with workers who say they prefer the current system. The companies also argue keeping workers as contractors reduces labor costs, keeping prices for customers low. All right, coming up, how do you make sure kids online don't see videos of Mickey Mouse or Peppa Pig in inappropriate situations? We'll discuss what it took for YouTube to figure it out. That's after the break.
Greater connectivity benefits the greater good. And Qualcomm invented 5G breakthroughs that make it possible. See us where 5G is helping to make remote education more accessible. Join us in making the world more connected with 5G.
Back in 2015, YouTube launched a kids-targeted version of its video service. The idea was pretty simple. Create a safe online space for kids to watch videos, where parents could trust their children wouldn't be exposed to harmful, violent, or sexually explicit material. But actually creating a platform that lived up to those promises proved to be a lot harder. And as more social media companies make a push to welcome kids and tweens, what lessons can they learn from YouTube's experience? Joining us to discuss this is our tech reporter, Yori Ko, with some new reporting on how the company approached these issues. Hi, Yori. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Zoe. Thanks for having me.
Over the last year, there's been a lot of conversation about how social media platforms interact with young users, you know, teenagers, but also tweens, you know, this kind of 9 to 12-year-old age who maybe aren't supposed to be on the platforms, but get on there anyway. But YouTube Kids started in 2015. What was behind their decision at that time, and how did they go about creating the platform?
What's interesting about YouTube is that kids' content has been popular on the platform since the earliest of days on YouTube. Cartoons, animations, nursery rhymes, all content that is clearly geared towards kids has just been incredibly popular. It's garnered billions and billions of views. The tricky part for YouTube is that kids technically aren't supposed to be on the main YouTube platform. Like many tech platforms, kids under the age of 13 should not be there. The popularity of the kids' content made it increasingly a difficult reality for YouTube to keep saying that there aren't kids on the platform, yet they have all this kids' content that is getting billions of views. So they were worried about, you know, regulators starting to pay attention to them. They were also getting an increasing number of complaints from parents about the kind of content that their kids were coming across on the main site, because the main site not just hosts kids' content, but a lot of mature content, and some of that was slipping into their feeds. And so as a way to kind of head off this reputational hit, YouTube executives decided it was maybe a wise time to create a standalone product just for kids.
Okay, but I can imagine one of the biggest hurdles for the platform would be figuring out how to moderate it, how to keep inappropriate or mature content off of the site. From your reporting, what did you find out about the thinking behind approaching this from the start?
Sure. I mean, you have to remember that the objective for YouTube to create YouTube Kids, which at the time was pretty novel, they were the very first tech company to do so, to take their main product and be like, let's create a kids version for this. The objective was to bolster the reputation, to show regulators, lawmakers, parents, we are YouTube. We are taking the issue of kids' safety seriously, and this is what we're doing to show you how seriously we're taking it. We're going to pour a lot of resources into building this new product just for kids to make sure it's a safe place for kids. But then they went about it kind of using the same principles that ruled the main platform, which was, you know, algorithmic curation, little human review, which doesn't work so well on a kids platform where you really do need some editorial intervention by humans to make that judgment call of, is this safe or not safe for kids?
Once they did make that change, how much of an effect did it have on the platform? I mean, if you were a YouTube Kids user before versus after, what would your experience have been like when it changed?
Well, when I talked to parents, they said that the main difference that they noticed was, one, the weird stuff was gone. So I don't know if you remember, but back when YouTube Kids launched, it wasn't soon after launch that we started seeing media reports. We started seeing notes from researchers and studies showing that the content on there just wasn't that great. On the really bad end, there were strange cartoon parodies of, you know, these popular cartoon characters like Peppa Pig and Paw Patrol put in like really obscene and violent situations. And so those videos have largely disappeared from the site. They also have been much stricter about enforcing certain policies that already existed, but they were perhaps too lax about actually looking for and enforcing across the platform, which, and I'm primarily talking about their commercial content policy, which means it targeted a lot of videos where the central message was, look at this shiny brand new toy, as opposed to look at this kid playing with this toy in a cool and educational kind of a way. So they were much more proactive about looking for the kinds of videos that seem to promote pure consumerism versus going and playing with a toy after you finish watching the video.
What do we know now about how those shifts affected YouTube? I mean, was there a change in their business model or the way they had to operate in order to react to parents' concerns?
I think the biggest takeaway is that it takes a lot more work to build a kids platform. It's also a lot more expensive, and the ROI on that is not immediate. And I think YouTube knows that, right? They're very smart people, that, and their objective, just like McDonald's with their Happy Meals, is to get their brand, their product, in front of kids as early as possible so those kids become lifelong customers. So in that sense, I think they're okay with not having YouTube Kids, you know, contribute a ton to the bottom line, but it certainly has been a much more expensive endeavor than I think they initially had anticipated.
So there's the expense, but I wonder what other lessons other platforms that want to go after tweens and kids might learn from YouTube's experience.
I think you have to remember that YouTube Kids ostensibly targets everyone under 13. That is a huge demographic. A 3-year-old is very different from a 13-year-old. And so to create a platform that serves all those different age groups, like toddlers, preschoolers, elementary school students, and then tweens, is hard. And then especially at the tween end of things, you know, these are kids who are on the cusp of becoming teenagers. They want to be cool. They don't want to be thought of as kids. And when you name your product YouTube Kids, that's not where they want to be. They want to be on the main site where there's also just a lot more inventory of videos to watch. YouTube Kids has stripped out some of that more mature stuff. So, I mean, they've been, I think, more cognizant of the fact they want more tweens on there. So they're adding some of that sporting and video games, like, you know, the Minecraft videos back in. But it is hard to convince a tween that something called YouTube Kids is a cool place to be. So I think, I mean, that does speak to how difficult this challenge is for tech companies. YouTube has been at this for, 7 years now? And they're still trying to get it right. So the idea that if Instagram were to launch Instagram Kids, it could take that long, if not longer, depending on kind of where their mindset is, how prepared they are to really invest the proper amount of resources to create a good kids product.
All right, that was our reporter, Yori Koh. Thanks for joining us, Yori.
Thanks, Zoe.
And that's it for today's Tech News Briefing. If you want more tech stories, check out our website, WSJ.com. And if you like our show, please rate and review it. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Zoe Thomas for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for your interest in the WSJ podcasts from The Wall Street Journal. We're always looking to improve, and we're interested in hearing your opinions. Please go to WSJ.com/survey. And take a survey that will help us bring you more of the content you're looking for. Thank you for your time and support.